Good afternoon. I'm Cal Winslow, your host. I'm very happy to be back with KZY X and Z this summer with a new series of programs. I'm calling these an antinomian hour. I'm using the word antinomian, an old concept, to describe people who work against the grain, people who believe that doing the right thing is the important thing. Our program will consist of a series of in-depth interviews broadcast here on KZYX every Thursday this summer at 1 p.m. Our guest today is Craig Marillies. Craig is the Director of Communications for the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, ILWU, the legendary union with origins in the general strike of 1934, 80 years ago this summer, a strike that revolutionized working conditions on the West Coast waterfronts. Craig is a veteran of two decades of trade union work, including with AFSCME at the University of California and in the reform movement in the Teamsters Union. He's a graduate of UC Santa Cruz and lives in Sausalito. Hello, Craig.
Hi, Cal. Great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you, and there are a couple of things that are maybe of interest for listeners. I'm certainly interested this summer, and one is the fact that you have a major contract that's expiring, I think, next month, and two, that this is also the summer, the 80th anniversary of the big West Coast strike. Could we talk about those?
Sure. Let's... There's a lot of history as well as contemporary struggles that are underway that probably be of interest to some of our listeners.
Well, that's great. Well, but first, let's just start. And could you just tell us, what is the ILWU today? You know, who's involved? What's represented? Maybe a bit about the issues?
Sure. Well, the name tells us a little bit. It's both longshore workers, meaning workers that provide the service to load and unload and take care of ships as they arrive and depart and are docked here at our shores. Those longshore workers are combined with warehouse, industrial, and service workers on the West Coast. So the union represents workers in California, Oregon, Washington, Hawaii, and there are also separate autonomous divisions in Panama, representing workers, some workers at the Panama Canal, as well as workers in Canada who have their own separate ILWU, or International Longshore and Warehouse Union Canada. Altogether, it's about 50,000 workers. That makes it one of the smaller unions in the constellation of unions, either in part of the coalition of unions in the AFL-CIO or independent unions. So it's a relatively small union, but one with a fascinating history and relatively militant and outspoken history as well, and some amount of controversy.
And what exactly, Craig, do you do in your work?
Well, I've been working as the communications director for the ILWU for the past 7 years. So I help them with their publications. We publish a monthly newspaper called The Dispatcher, and we also have a website with that's updated daily with news of concern and interest to the members.
And would you mind saying a word about how you got interested in this kind of work?
I got interested in labor unions because I started doing work as a community organizer, going door to door, helping people in neighborhoods take on concerns and issues that required people power to solve problems. So at a relatively early age, 18 or 19, I was trying to build neighborhood and community organizations to help people take on and solve problems that they were unable to take on by themselves, but could win if they got together and used their power together to put pressure on City Hall or other elected officials.
Hmm.
The transition to labor union work came after many different jobs that I had doing community organizing. Some of it involved working on elections to try and get people elected who would respect people power, respond to the democratic impulse of people coming together and asking for reforms, changes, improvements. And it became increasingly obvious to me that these kinds of organizations are precious and actually quite rare in our society. Organizations composed of people with a democratic impulse are few and far between. So neighborhood organizations are hard to build and increasingly rare. We don't find many of them. Certainly many that are willing to engage beyond, complaining about somebody not watering their lawn or relatively minor trivial issues concerning the big questions in society. How do we allocate the resources? How do we share? How do we decide who gets what in the society? Those fundamentally democratic questions are best addressed by organizations of people, and labor unions constitute one of the few examples in our society where people come together for their common self-interest and try and act in a way to express their democratic needs in the society. There are other examples. Churches sometimes provide some of those functions. And certainly big business organizations are the best organized, but they become so powerful and so predominant in the society that we desperately need a counterforce, a democratic counterforce. And I'm talking small d democratic, meaning a voice of the people. And those kinds of organizations are rare and precious, and labor unions are one of the few places that working families can have a voice.
Okay. Now, I think we think of longshoremen as kind of archetypical blue-collar workers.
Right.
And if people know anything about them today, they probably would think of them as being fairly well organized, of having benefits, of kind of being up the, maybe a bad choice of words, up the food chain a bit, say, compared to the fast food workers that we hear so much about. But in pre-1934 work, it wasn't really that way. Could you tell us a bit about, say, the background to 1934?
You know, today longshore workers are paid well. They have some of the best wages and benefits of any blue-collar workers in America. And the interesting thing is it wasn't always that way. The workers have been able to gain and to win really an amazing transformation of their jobs and their work from among the lowest paid, the least respected, and the really some of the most abusive working conditions, and transformed in a matter of 80 years those jobs from some of the worst to some of the best in America. It happened because the workers were able to win a strong contract that allowed them to negotiate as peers and with the powerful companies that control the international trade that comes to our shores with ships full of merchandise coming and going. And in the past, before 1934, the workers on the docks were a contingent labor force, much like we hear about today with workers that are employed by temp agencies. At the time, before 1934, and for many, many decades, from the mid-1800s, as the West Coast was settled, the workers were considered the lowest of the low. They were called wharf rats. They had no rights, and they were terribly abused. Many of them had to pay off the foreman in order to get hired for even a day's job, and sometimes not even a full day. Or it could be hired for a job that might take days without end and no breaks, where people were worked for 24 or 48 hours straight. Workers had no say and no voice. And through a remarkable series of events, workers took control and dramatically changed the relations of power on the docks. And that was so inspiring and exciting that word of their success spread throughout workers nearby, and they were able to build a very large and strong union that became part of the movement of the mid-1930s for workers to gain rights and respect on the job through their unions.
Craig, just before we get there, I think of what you're describing sometimes in terms of casual labor and the shape-up. Was that the system here on the West Coast as well as the East?
That's right. This term shape-up refers to a very primitive system of recruiting labor that really involved nothing more than a man with jobs to offer who was usually working for a big company that owned the ship or contracted to unload or load the ship. And that person would holler out that he had jobs available. Workers would then desperately crowd around and say, "I want to work." And someone would say, "No, I want to work." On the docks.
Yeah.
And as the ship was arriving, and it was due to arrive within hours or minutes, the people who needed work would throng to the docks and would desperately beg for work. I think the contemporary current day situation can still be seen with day laborers in almost all our cities today. Immigrant workers are gathering in certain areas, often where contractors know they can be found. And when they pull up in their trucks or their cars, they're immediately surrounded by desperate, often hungry workers begging for a chance to work. And the result was that the shape-up system often involved workers competing against each other to lower wages. You know, one worker would holler out, I'll work all day for 30 cents, and another would say, I'll do it for 20 cents. And by the end of the process, a handful of workers were chosen. They were working for pennies and leaving the jobs in poverty just as they began. And it often involved things that were much worse. Frequently, bribes and payoffs were required in order to get a job. So a worker might be expected to give back a significant portion of the wages they were paid, which were low to begin with, and after the payoffs and the bribes to the bosses, they were even less. There are stories of men having to prostitute their wives or girlfriends and literally be involved in slavery in order to get work. These were barbaric, brutal conditions, and no matter how hard they tried and attempted at different times to organize and do something about this, prior to 1934, they weren't successful. Now, one of the interesting lessons that was learned in this process was that the tendency of people to divide themselves and see minor distinctions in race or in age, in whether they were immigrants and whether they were newer immigrants or older immigrants, things that are still very much with our society today were very present in the early 1930s when workers were trying to build a union and trying to do something about these terrible exploitative conditions on the docks. And they found that this tendency for the boss to take advantage of the distinction between newer and older immigrants and more recent immigrants and older and younger workers. And at that point, there were no women allowed to even do the work. They couldn't even be considered. But these racial, ethnic, age, and status conditions were exploited, making it very, very difficult for workers to organize. And one of the main insights of the organizers who were attempting to help build a union up and down the West Coast was that they had to find a way to overcome these differences and had to begin educating workers that what they had in common was far more important than the differences they had. It didn't really matter if people were immigrants. It didn't matter if they were black or white or brown or yellow. What really mattered was they were all being taken advantage of, and only by coming together and forming an organization could they have any hope of dealing with powerful corporations that controlled the work on the docks. And they began to take that message up and down the coast to all the ports. Today there are 29 ports on the West Coast where longshore workers operate and where commerce is conducted. And in those days, workers would visit dozens of ports and travel and take this message that we need to build one big union to help each other, and we need to do our organizing all at once, so that if we're able to be strong in Seattle, we have to be strong in Tacoma and have to have strength in Portland, and we have to have the same kind of strength in San Francisco and Los Angeles. So the vision involved several factors. One big union working on the entire West Coast for the same good terms and conditions to be demanded by the workers all up and down at every port, so there would not be the kind of divide and conquer strategy to play one port off another, saying workers will work for 20 cents less in Tacoma. Maybe the Seattle workers should lower their pay 5 cents to get the work.
Craig.
That's what they were dreaming of, one big union with one standard. And in 1934, they finally felt strong enough to be able to launch their strike.
I hope you don't mind if I just throw in one question here that I may be controversial, but they had a union in before 1934, isn't that right? In terms of the bit that I know about the industry, in New York, for instance, in New York Harbor, just to kind of be the devil's advocate here for a second, it sort of did matter what your race was, whether you got work or not on the Brooklyn piers depended on if you were Italian or black or Irish. Those were incredibly important distinctions that were made, life and death distinctions. Was that the case out here at all?
You're absolutely right on both counts. There was a union in place. In fact, there were many unions in place that claimed to represent longshore workers up and down the West Coast. And there had been earlier unions set up from the late 1800s at many West Coast ports. The port of Tacoma, for example, is famous for having established a union that was able to make some progress and help workers at that port. But because it was at that port only, there were limitations. The other problem was that at a number of the other ports, there was always a company union, a union that was really not there to help workers, but was a phony union, a fake union, one that masqueraded and pretended to be a union for workers and might have had a union in the title, but was actually operated for the benefit of the employers. And these employer-controlled unions, known as think unions, controlled the waterfront and became a way that the employers could screen out what they regarded as troublemakers, workers who were asking too many questions, were wondering why they couldn't be paid a fair wage, why there couldn't be breaks, so that the exhaustion that made workers much more susceptible to dangerous injuries and even fatalities could be controlled. There was so little regard for the health and safety of the workers by these company or think unions that they became hated and resented. And yet, in many places, if there was no strong independent union, workers felt that they had to join these unions or they couldn't get any work. So belonging to one of these company or Fink unions and carrying a little union book called a Fink book, which is the only way you could get a job, became part of what workers had to put up with. The other problem that they had on the East Coast was unions were based on ethnicity, and unions were really very racist, and the unions had separate operations based on race and national origin, and they became very, very segregated from the beginning. On the West Coast, there was a strong effort by radicals who had a new perspective, and that perspective was what really mattered is that we were all workers, and that's the most important thing that we held in common, and the fact that some of us were black, white, brown, or yellow really didn't matter, and in fact, we needed to appreciate and all work together in order to overcome these attempts by the companies to divide and conquer workers. And those ideas eventually won out, and some of those ideas were carried by communists, people who were socialists inspired by what they thought was a new possibility that gave them hope through the Russian Revolution in 1917. So it was less than 20 years later that some of those workers felt that a new world was possible that would respect workers and provide them with new hope and possibility, and they were inspired to seek out this kind of dream in which workers would have their own organizations that would be truly independent and operate in their interests. This was long before they realized what was really happening in the Soviet Union and the nightmare that was unfolding there with the brutal repression and lack of democracy. But at the time, it was inspiring to workers, and they brought those ideas and messages to the West Coast, and many of those people were influenced as they traveled around the world from port to port, and one of those people was Harry Bridges.
Hey, Craig?
Yeah.
Can I pause here for a moment, and then we'll go right to what you're talking about
now.
This is KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host this afternoon, Cal Winslow. Our program, I'm calling an antinomian hour. Our guest today is Craig Merrilies. He's the communications director for the ILWU, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. So, Craig, I think we're getting to 1934, and you were talking about radicals on the waterfront. So maybe we could finish your thought about these people and then can you tell us a bit about the strike itself, the immediate conditions, what was going on, why it became so important, really legendary?
The years after World War I in America were turbulent and exciting, especially for workers who drew so much hope and inspiration from what they believed was a new world that could be brought about with workers having their own voice, independent organizations, and maybe even becoming the dominant voice in society for a change instead of having the owners and the big capitalists and bankers calling all the shots in society. Many of them drew inspiration from what they saw as positive events in what became the Soviet Union. Hard for us to believe today, and workers at the time didn't realize that brutal repression would follow the exciting heydays in which workers were asserting their right to govern for the first time. But at the time, it was very inspiring, and one of the people who was inspired by those events was a young sailor from Australia named Harry Bridges. And Harry Bridges came to the United States in the 1920s and stayed in San Francisco. It's interesting to note that he didn't have his papers in order. He was like many immigrants who came here without the papers and the documentation that he needed. He remained in San Francisco and based on what he'd seen around the world traveling as a merchant marine sailor, he took many of those ideas to workers in San Francisco and with other organizers, helped build a union that in 1934 was ready to call for a strike of all the ports on the West Coast. And they were demanding an end to the corruption and the abusive treatment, a democratic hiring hall so that workers could be work could be allocated in a fair and democratic way through a hiring hall that the workers would control, ending the shape-up system in which corruption and abuse was necessary to get a job, and to raise wages. They did that by challenging the old racial divisions that employers had used to divide workers, saying they wanted one big union that welcomed everyone to participate and get equal treatment for jobs. And in San Francisco and Los Angeles, Seattle, Tacoma, Portland, bitter conflicts took place as the strike unfolded. And early on in the conflict, workers were killed. First in Los Angeles, in the middle of May, two workers, Dickie Parker and John Knutson, were shot early in the morning of May 16th. And before it was over, workers would die at many of the ports up and down the coast in their effort to try and secure better wages and working conditions and fair treatment. In San Francisco, one of the bloody conflicts took place on the 5th of July when workers were shot in San Francisco and killed. Howard Sperry and Gene Olson were both killed on July 5th, both shot in the back by police as the police and their hired thugs attempted to beat strikers and break the picket lines. So these were very violent, very bloody conflicts. There were no laws in the books to protect workers or recognize their right to form unions, and workers had to do what they could to try and win those rights with their bare hands. And those martyrs continue to be celebrated on the docks today on the 5th of July, a date known as Bloody Thursday. The port shut down on the West Coast to honor and recognize the men who gave their lives so that others might have better lives for their families in the future.
And the strike was, at least in the Bay Area, became a general strike.
That's right. In San Francisco, something interesting happened, and that was there was a massive outpouring of public sympathy. The media at the time was completely against the workers, with the exception of a handful of socialist newspapers that were sympathetic to the strikers. But the big business interests at the time were furious that workers were rebelling and speaking out. And after the police shot those two men in San Francisco, the longshore workers organized a silent march up Market Street, the main street in San Francisco, and they were very dignified. They were absolutely silent. There was no protesting. There was no shouting or screaming. And they made this very unusual and very dramatic display of both solidarity and of calling attention to the killing and the abuse of workers in a very dignified way. And it immediately captured the attention of the entire city, and the business interests were caught off guard, and support for a general strike followed this display and resulted in a complete shutdown of the city for several days. And it was bitterly debated about whether this could or should continue, but the tremendous outpouring of public support for the workers led to the end of the strike and the triumph of the workers over the big business interests. And it was done because of the overwhelming public support that they were able to garner through the general strike that followed the killing and sacrifice of the two martyrs in San Francisco.
And did they abolish the shape-up? Did they win a hiring hall?
Not only they won all their key demands. They were able to end the abusive hiring system called the shape-up. They were able to get a hiring hall that would be democratic and fair, allocating work on a first-come, first-served basis, recognizing the importance of seniority. And most importantly, they were able to win a contract that covered all 29 ports on the West Coast so that employers weren't able to whipsaw or force workers to compete against each other, driving down wages and working conditions. So one contract for all the ports, the same conditions that provided significant raises and recognition that workers would henceforth talk with the employers with one voice through their union, and it was a tremendous triumph and a great victory. And this so inspired other workers that the union began to receive enthusiastic appeals from other workers nearby the ports who wanted to join. So the warehouses that were adjacent to the ports saw an outpouring of workers who came and wanted to sign up and join the union. And these were not all easy. There were bitter conflicts, but the momentum at this point was on the side of workers. And literally within several years, the union grew into a very large and powerful movement that was inspiring workers all over the country. And the same thing was happening with workers in the industrial heartland and all over America. This is the mid-1930s, and it marked a dramatic change both in the living standards for workers and the sense of hope and opportunity that it brought.
And this specific strike helped lead to the unionization drives of the 1930s and the CIO, is that right?
I think the longshore strike of 1934 and the general strike that followed is generally recognized as one of the seminal events in American labor history and led to the establishment of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the widespread organizing of industrial workers, and the creation of many, many new unions and a mass movement of workers that dramatically changed the future of the country. And there were general strikes that followed in other locations. And there was the strike by Teamster members in Minneapolis that followed, and strikes at General Motors, the famous sit-down strikes that followed. There was so much public support for the idea that workers had new rights that cried out to be recognized that President Roosevelt signed the dramatic piece of labor legislation exactly 1 year later, and he did so on Bloody Thursday to make a point of the sacrifice that workers had made. He signed that legislation in Tacoma, Washington, in 1935 on July 5th, exactly 1 year after the martyrs had been killed in San Francisco. And that legislation, for the first time, recognized the right of workers to form unions, their right to negotiate and do so collectively with one voice when negotiating with their employers.
I don't know if this may be rural myth, but I came across the idea that sort of, to bring the story a little closer to home, that one of the reasons that the big mills up here in the north stopped shipping their lumber out on the seas was for fear of the ILWU coming into places like Fort Bragg and Eureka, and then they turned strictly to rail and then trucking. Do you think that could be true?
I think it could be true. I mean, the lumber barons had been terrified of workers organizing for many decades. The rise of the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, had a dramatic influence on workers around the First World War, and many of those experiences shaped the ILWU, the Longshore and Warehouse Union, that followed. These were labor organizers and radicals that affected several generations of workers, and their ideas were simple but very powerful. They believed in the principle of one big union to represent all workers. They believed that they were stronger together. Their slogan, "An injury to one is an injury to all," was adopted by the Longshore and Warehouse Union workers. Many of those struggles took place in the mines of the West and the lumber camps of the West. And the employers were absolutely terrified of workers having a greater voice. And sadly, they formed vigilante committees that beat and in some cases murdered, hanged, and terrified workers that were thought to be sympathizers to either the IWW or the ILWU. But in the end, the public opinion and the public support overwhelmed the thugs and the hired guns and the private police and even the public police at the time that were taking the side of the big business against workers. And those were all, they were vanquished and overwhelmed by the public and popular support.
One last thing, and then we'll maybe shift gears a bit, but the hiring hall, it became the mechanism for attempting to root out discrimination, racial discrimination in particular. Is that fair? And maybe, do you know any of mechanically how that could work?
Well, the idea that workers had was that they would have their own system that would be conducted in a fair, honest, open, and democratic way to allocate work, because the work was contingent. One never knew that when the ships would come or go and how long it would take to load or unload them. So this was a contingent workforce of temporary workers, and they needed a fair way to allocate that work and wanted nothing to do with the shape-up system that had been so abusive and taken advantage of workers in the past when the companies made those decisions. So they negotiated an arrangement to have workers themselves work with the companies to set up these hiring halls that would be managed by workers and would do so according to seniority, so that a worker would get a job and then would come back to the hiring hall and get in line and wait until others had had an opportunity to work before they got another chance again. And that system, based on seniority, through a union hiring hall, became a powerful and important part of the longshore tradition and an inspiration to other workers for how workers could take charge, take control, and make sure that work was allocated fairly.
We get the impression, though, often, probably more than the impression, that the problem is the racism of the workers themselves. I mean, was that challenged in the union? Or?
There were terrible debates within the ILWU involving race that persisted and you know, in some sense, continue today. The racial distinctions that exist between us continue to be an opportunity that employers would like to exploit, and sometimes workers themselves, out of ignorance and superstition and family lessons they learned, have unfortunately drawn the wrong conclusions and sought to divide each other. In general, the union has a very good and an admirable record of confronting racial discrimination and was one of the few unions to start in the 1930s in the Bay Area, anyway, as a fully and proudly integrated union that welcomed workers of all colors, creeds, and races and nationalities. So there were certainly racial conflicts that emerged up and down the coast because other locations were slower and more reluctant to adopt a multiracial open-door policy. And some of those conflicts endured into the 50s, 60s, and later. But at this point, the ILWU has one of the best reputations for combating racism and taking on the kind of discrimination that exists in all of its forms, and is generally proud to help others and try and set an example for what a democratic, multiracial organization looks like and how much stronger it can be as a result of taking that approach.
Craig, I need to pause again and say that this is KZYXNZ, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host this afternoon, Cal Winslow. Our program today is looking at the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, and we're speaking with its Director of Communications, Craig Merrilies. Well, Craig, maybe in the time that we have left, and we still have some time, we could talk a bit about the transformation of the waterfront in the period that followed. And maybe what I'll ask you first is about the historic agreement in 1960, I think it was, the Mechanization and Modernization Agreement. Not so much to the details of that agreement itself, but what was the mechanization issue?
Well, the issue facing workers was new technology was being developed, primarily the shipping container, something we take for granted today and see everywhere on the highway, on the back of a truck or on the back of a train, and shiploads full of containers was something that didn't exist in the early 1960s. It was a new technology. And it had the prospect of revolutionizing the productivity of the shipping industry by being able to dramatically increase the speed with which volumes of material could be loaded and unloaded on ships. And the second great advantage of the container system that was developed in the 1950s was that it could be intermodal. It could move easily. That box, as it was called, could move from a ship to a train or to a truck, and relatively seamlessly and quickly, instead of having to load and unload each time it shifted the mode of transportation. So these were huge and dramatic changes that were taking place on the docks, and the union had to confront this within its own ranks. And workers engaged in a democratic, open, and sometimes heated debate and discussion about what to do. There were some who wanted to oppose the technology and try and fight the introduction of the new containers. Others who felt resigned but wanted to see some kind of compensation. And most workers were afraid that they'd be losing their jobs. Others thought that if they retired, there'd be no workers behind them to help pay for the pensions and retirements that they had been counting on. So very difficult problems. In the end, they were able to reach an agreement between the union and the companies that provided for the introduction of the new technology, but providing workers with a dramatically increased share of the higher productivity. In other words, workers would share in the profits that the companies were making through using this new technology. And while the size of the workforce was reduced significantly, those workers who remained on the docks were much better paid and received much better benefits. They also found a humane and reasonable way to transition workers that were on the docks that might be getting close to retirement but were still many years away, and so they came up with a way to encourage those folks to retire sooner. They were given incentives, and these kinds of arrangements became important models for a way to handle this kind of a dramatic change in the workplace in a humane and reasonable way. And it certainly includes some influence on the decisions being made today, as some of the employers are preparing to introduce robotics and new technology onto the docks that will again replace people in many cases.
And the work itself was transformed, wasn't it? I mean, I don't know if people will have seen the old film On the Waterfront with Marlon Brando, and you think of these sort of big, strong, thick-waisted, highly skilled men, almost always working in the holds of ship. That's no longer the typical longshoreman, is that right?
Well, I think it's fair to say that the longshore work still involves working outside in all sorts of weather. It's still physical work, and there's still difficult, rigorous manual labor associated with longshore work. But it has evolved to become much more mechanized, and the amount of brutal physical labor has been reduced significantly compared to the old days when workers had to rig up slings to haul all the different cargoes that were loaded into ships. And in the case of bulk cargoes, whether they were bricks or grain or shreds of coconut or sacks of coffee and cocoa, at one point men literally put many of these bags on their back and had to haul and hoist these things in very, very demanding circumstances. So that's been replaced by the containers today. So there's been a dramatic change in the workforce. There are more women. There are workers that don't have to be professional weightlifters to be able to get the jobs done. But they're still demanding. They're still difficult. They're still physical. And workers are still required to climb these many stories high up on the ships to release the containers, a process known as lashing, to either secure or unsecure the containers when they're being loaded or unloaded. So the work remains dangerous. It remains difficult. But it's certainly different than it was in what was called the break bulk era, without the containerization that took place.
And then another transition, I think in the last couple generations, we've seen both the decline of the old inner cities, and along with that decline there seems to have been a decline on the urban waterfront and the seaports of places like San Francisco, Seattle, New York, Brooklyn, quite dramatic, really. But now the ports seem to be back, and perhaps it's nowhere so striking as here in California. So could you bring us up to date? What's happening?
Well, the ports that are handling large numbers of containers, and there really are the main ones, are Los Angeles, Long Beach, often treated as one giant complex where 85% of the containers move through the West Coast. So that one is the big enchilada in Southern California, handling most of the container traffic. But Oakland handles a significant amount. Seattle and Tacoma also handle significant amounts of containers. Smaller ports like Portland and others are also involved, but in a much smaller scale. The port communities look different than they did, 80 years ago. Many of the workers live nearby, but some of them live further out and commute to their jobs at the ports. But they still remain strongly involved, in most cases, in these port communities. And workers from the Longshore Union continue to be involved in civic affairs in San Francisco and Los Angeles, and especially in San Pedro and Long Beach, and in the other port communities. So there is a tradition of the longshore workers being involved in their communities, helping with charities, participating in fundraisers, and being involved in the political life of those communities to be advocates for working families, whether they're in the ILWU or not. And the ILWU members tend to be involved in these struggles and fights to try and achieve a measure of justice in those communities.
Okay, and you know, I saw you back in Chicago not so long ago at a conference, and at the conference there were some longshoremen in attendance, but interestingly, including longshoremen from the U.S., but also from, I think, Chile and Hong Kong and different parts of the United States. And one of the things that I heard people say, and maybe you could comment on this, was, you know, we work for the same companies, we work on the very same ships, and this has to be important in the way we think about our lives and our work. Could you say something about that?
These ideas that an injury to one is an injury to all, and that workers in different countries are really in the same situation and often dealing with the same companies and certainly the same problems, has become adopted as a central principle at the Longshore and Warehouse Union. And from the beginning, the union has tried to help and support workers in other countries as they went through situations and circumstances not unlike the ones that longshore workers faced. So there's a ready response by longshore workers when they hear about a problem involving workers in another country, especially dock workers. They're more than happy to do what they can to try and help. Sometimes there are laws and rules and regulations that make that challenging, but longshore workers have a long history of what they call solidarity, or helping others in need, and that applies to the charitable work they do in their communities, but also to supporting other workers in other countries. And it's become a central principle of the ILWU, and they often come to the aid and support of workers in trouble around the world, most notably the workers in South Africa when they were struggling to overcome apartheid, received help from ILWU members. When Japan invaded China in the late 1930s, workers refused to handle ships that were supporting that regime. The same was true for Hitler and his business interests when they would send shiploads before World War II. The longshoremen refused to work on some of those ships. So these kinds of ties are important, and they're part of the ILWU culture today.
Okay, and we've got a little bit of time left, Craig. We're I think it's fair to say that you or the union faces some pretty significant challenges today. There have been some very difficult battles up in the Pacific Northwest on the Columbia River, and you're facing contract negotiations this summer. Could you tell us a little bit about what the issues are in these places and maybe a bit about some of the problems that the union confronts and will have to deal with?
Well, there are several challenges the ILWU faces today. One of them is the new technology that's being introduced that includes robotics. Employers are anxious to deploy those, although they're very expensive, typically involving billions of dollars in investment. So it won't happen overnight, but that's a process that's underway. So the union wants to be able to secure good jobs that may be related to the maintenance, repair, and operation of those robotic systems. The union continues to be concerned about the grain contracts for the Pacific Northwest region, where vast quantities and much of the grain that's exported to Asia goes through a handful of ports that are controlled by a handful of companies, foreign-owned for the most part. And these foreign-owned companies have refused to continue the contracts that they had negotiated with the ILWU since the 1930s, and they're taking a belligerent and bellicose stand to try and challenge the ILWU. But the ILWU has held fast and is maintaining a firm position that good wages, working conditions, and fair treatment should be a part of the huge multinational grain trade that can afford to treat workers fairly, especially these foreign-owned operators that are challenging American workers in the Northwest. And the current agreement covering the majority of longshore workers expires on the 30th of June. Those talks, those negotiations are underway now, both for contract and new safety rules and regulations. And they're moving along, and we'll have to see what happens when the contract expires. But there's a commitment to try and reach a fair agreement. The issues involved there include the new technology, tremendous increases in healthcare costs, not because the inflation, but because the Obama administration is imposing a tax on quality healthcare plans. And it's been estimated that $150 million might have to be paid in fines because workers have a good healthcare plan. And nobody's anxious to pay that bill. So those are some real challenges that workers are facing in the upcoming negotiations.
Okay, and then to just finish up with, I mean, there seems to be a movement in the country that faces pretty much all unions and all workers, an anti-union, a new kind of anti-union, what we might call open shop or something movement. Here in California, there's been recently the legal attack on the rights of teachers to tenure. Just speaking for yourself now, not necessarily for the union, what do you see as the source of this anti-union drive and this the mood which seems to want to blame people like teachers for the country's problems?
I think as long as workers have tried to stand up for their rights and ask questions and demand a modicum of justice, there's been resistance from people in power. The people that control the economic institutions are not comfortable with workers being assertive and questioning the unilateral control of people who own things in the society. That makes them uncomfortable, and that makes them push back against workers and the institutions they create, whether they're unions or associations or whatnot. That genders a response, and it should be no surprise that employers are continuing to try and get rid of unions in this day and age. I think they sense unions are weaker, and some of them are moving in for the kill. So there are very few employers that are not trying to get rid of unions and exterminate the power of workers to form associations and groups to speak up for the interest of working families. It's also true that unions themselves have sometimes failed to evolve in ways that move beyond the kind of self-interest that unions are good at, but are no longer effective in a day and age when only a tiny percentage of workers belong to unions. It's hard for workers that aren't in a union to be sympathetic if all they see is a group that seems to be looking out for itself. So the challenge for workers today and their unions is to do things that act for the broader public interest as well as the narrow interests of the workers involved. So it means fighting for Social Security, fighting for better minimum wages for all workers, fighting for better safety and health and environmental laws, not just for folks in one workplace, but for every workplace. And workers have done some of this through their unions, but we need to do much, much more, I think, if we're going to be able to capture the support of the general public that we need in order to take on the increasing and dangerous control of our society by big business interests that have become so predominant.
Craig, I'm going to have to call an end to this now. Thank you very much. It's really been a pleasure. It's been very informative. So thanks for coming on the program. And I want to thank the listeners for tuning in and say that we've been talking with Craig Merrilies, the communications director of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. I'm your host, Cal Winslow. I'll be back next week at this same time. So thanks for tuning in and good afternoon.